Mr. Tyler, Real 2. We're talking about your attitude to Churchill, and you're saying yours wasn't an unstinting admiration in the sense that you did have reservations about some parts. Were there any other than the munitions question, and any other questions or doubts you had about Churchill?
Well, there was always the question of what was going to happen post-war and what sort of, you know, we all thought in terms of building a land fit for heroes to return to, etc. And one could never really feel that Churchill was seriously interested in the development of education and health services and that sort of thing, although of course it was true that he got various important reports written, including of course the Beveridge report. And this was really my big thing, although the Beveridge report didn't come out until November of 42, when I was at Cambridge. Now, wait a minute, no. I just joined the army. We haven't got to me joining the army.
Okay, well, we'll hold back on it. That's probably. I think the next thing then is when you go to Cambridge. Yeah. When did you go to Cambridge?
Oh, yes, I'm only to say, yes, I think that's a bit I must say, that my best friend, the CSM, and myself,
right,
both had scholarships or exhibitions at Cambridge, and we were very exercised as to should we. It was feasible in those days to go up to Cambridge for a year, or any other university, for God's sake, in the middle of the war, and then join the army immediately afterwards. And we were very worried about, was this the correct thing to do, so to speak? We'd got this mental picture of everybody in the First World War rushed off at the age of 16 or something. And so we were used to have an annual inspection of the OTC. We were inspected in that year by a fellow called General Crocker, and we asked to see him and asked for his guidance. And he said, well, look, I think you chaps will be more used to the army as officers in a year's time when you're 19 rather than trying to send you straight off to watch you at the moment. So we said, fair enough, and we went up to Cambridge for a year.
Which college did you go to?
I was at Selwyn. My friend was at John's.
And you were doing English?
I was.
English, yes. Literature?
I was, yes.
And what was your life like at Cambridge generally for that year?
Desperately busy, desperately busy. Broadly speaking, I'd never been out with a girl in my life before, which changed a bit. But I was intensely interested in the Labour Party and the Labour Club aspect of it. Indeed, my first day in Cambridge, I went into a room in St. John's College, Cambridge, to find the secretary of the Cambridge University Labour Party, and there on a sofa was almost the prettiest girl I've ever seen in my life, and she is now Lady Jenkins. Jennifer Morris, as she then was, the daughter of the town clerk of Westminster, who lived up the road here, and of course we all took a terribly poor view of her because she went off and married a chap from Oxford, which we regarded as a cardinal sin. So I was trying to do some work, and I was very fortunate in my tutor.
Hang on, tell me more about this Labour Club. You went to join the Labour Club on the first day. What happened? You met Morris, and who was the actual secretary at the time of the Labour Club? Do you recall? Or what sort of reception did you get, anyway?
Oh, well, it was great. You know, it was a great amount of activity going on. And a lot of it, of course, was immediately up against this problem of one's relationships with the communists. Because Cambridge was a divided, on the socialist side, it was divided into two. You had a thing called the Socialist Society, which was communist and its allies, and the Labour Club, who were rather more, if you like, orthodox Labour. And I never had the slightest doubt that my place was in the Orthodox Labour. But of course, there'd just been the end of the Hitler-Russian pact, and Russia had become an ally, and our gallant Russian allies were doing most of the fighting that was actually being done against the Germans in Europe at that stage. So there was a tremendous sort of surge of pro-Russian feeling. But when it came to communism itself and the Russian version of communism, I and my generation, I think, were deeply affected by Arthur Koestler's work on this, particularly a book called Darkness at Noon, which was the most graphic description of the way in which aggressive communist dictatorships suppressed all other activity, etc. So we tried to take up an attitude of saying, well, yes, of course, we're dead keen that the Russians are beating up the Germans, even though they may have been a bit dodgy a year previously. But that doesn't mean that we've got to accept their ideology or their ways of running a state about which we were deeply suspicious. But of course, you used to get all sorts of factions who tried to persuade you that you ought not to be in this, but you should be in the other. So it was intense ideological activity in sort of club meetings, etc. And I was sent to see Sir Stafford Cripps in the House of Commons to get him to come to address a meeting on one day, and he put his arms round my shoulders in the lobby and said, "My boy, I'm afraid I can't do that for you. I'm just being sent by the Prime Minister to Russia to go and talk to the government there and make sure that we're sending them all the aid that we can to support them in their struggles." So the whole Russian situation was desperately big to us at that moment. And there was me trying to tear my life into these academic bits, the political bit. I joined the union and was trying to speak at the union because I thought that I ought to do. I was playing golf for the university. I was actually meeting girls, would you believe it? So it was a very, very hectic first year.
Were you in the OTC at all, or was there an OTC at Cambridge?
Yes,
there
was, and I had been thinking of joining the Navy, but there was no naval special OTU type unit in Cambridge. And I said, well, my father was in the, although he, I suppose, had been originally in an infantry battalion, but he'd become the brigade signals officer with his post office background, so I might as well join the signals, something I know absolutely nothing about. So I joined the signals, and that proved to be...
At Cambridge?
At Cambridge. The signals, they called it pre-training unit, and did a year there. But, you know, that's when I started again on this wireless theory, and not having done any bloody science at all since I was 14.
How did you find it then? Difficult, obviously.
Yes, I did. Yes. But, you know, I felt it was a very poor show that I hadn't done any science since I was 14. So to that extent. So that's another thing. One was split into about six different bits of activity. But very, very interesting. Very interesting.
And what sort of political activity were you doing then? I mean, how were the debates conducted with the Communists? I mean, would you attend their meetings and heckle them and they heckle you? Or how did it go about? Or was it leafleting? Or was it or was it just standing for the college elections for the union?
I never bothered with college level. I was straight into university level. In other words, the clubs I was involved in were university-based, not club, not college-based. There was also one called CICU. CUSIO, Cambridge University Society of International Affairs. Used to go to a lot of their meetings. They weren't political. They were genuine people who knew about foreign affairs, coming and talking detail. But no, this was all really debates within... I became editor of the magazine of the Labour Club. So I was writing stuff for them. I was having great discussions about, you know, how far did we, yes, we were supporting the Russians in their war effort, but did we support their ideology? What did we think about what Churchill was doing in the House of Commons or wasn't doing, and rebuilding things for the future or planning to rebuild things for the future? And that was the level. I mean, apart from the debating in the Union, this tended to be very intense discussions within the weekly meetings of the Cambridge University Labour Club. That was the forum in which I was operating.
Did you ever debate head-on with the Socialist Society, or was it more debates within the Labour Club?
Well, yes, we didn't have much in the way of head-on. I think you're quite right. We didn't have much in the way of head-on. And some of the leaders of the Socialist Society were able and energetic people. I mean, we weren't saying they were a lot of criminals.
Who? Do you remember any names for either club, in fact?
Well, Peter Shaw didn't join my executive till I got back after the war. So he, of course, I went back to Cambridge after the war, and Peter Shaw was on my executive. There was a very bright guy called Sebastian Pease, who was one of these chaps who organised the dropping of all this tinsely stuff to deflect. He was a physics man. His sister married the master of, or a guy who became the master of Trinity. Oh, yeah, Huxley. Huxley, the master of Trinity. So these are the sort of people I was knocking about with all the time and arguing with. There was a very famous New Zealander who was the leader of the communists in the Socialist Society. Dudley Sears. Wasn't he a chief government economist or something after the war? Dudley Sears. There was a very bright chap called Murray Hunter, who I think played rugby for Scotland on one occasion. But I can't, that's about as much as I can tell you about that side. It was pretty hectic. And of course, we all lived on bicycles, cycled everywhere, including I had to cycle. I had to take my golf clubs, and I used to go and play golf. I had to go everywhere on the bike. There were days where the university golf teams had vehicles. We didn't have anything like that in that year in the middle of the war.
Anything else about your time in Cambridge?
Well, you see, we get to coming back again. We haven't got into the army yet, have we? Can we just go into the army a bit? Because
okay, so you were there for a year.
Yeah.
And then how did you come to join up?
Well, I've forgotten what I did in terms of application, etc. I went straight from Cambridge to what they call the Signals Pre-Optu at Rooton.
That was in September 42?
Well, probably August, if not July, because the university term, you see, finishes in early in June. So we are more or less free to dash off and do that then. And this is sort of basic training in things like Morse code and the basics of signals and, you know, jumping off trees and catching ropes. Although I was once jumped off a tree and failed to catch the rope, which did some damage to my back, which came in later. And then after about 8 weeks, it was while I was there. No, then we moved to the main signals up to Patrick. And that was hard work, but we were lucky in that we had very good weather, and it meant that the physical side of the thing wasn't as tough as it can be in the middle of the winter when you were supposed, you know, they let you off swimming through lakes and things when they were just about frozen.
Now, what was the training like at Catterick? What sort of syllabus did they have to train you as an officer?
Well, some of it, of course, was drill, I suppose, which I possibly knew more about than most, having been sort of CPMS, RSM at school, you were doing the same sort of stuff. Basically, wireless theory, my recollection of it is that it was pretty well organised. We did a sort of bit of everything. We didn't have time to get desperately close to too much.
Did you do, I mean, were you doing telephones, telephone exchanges as well as wireless, or was it concentrating on wireless?
There was line as well, but from the theoretical point of view, the wireless theory was very much more, you know, I can remember all these diagrams of fermionic valves and things. I couldn't tell you much about them at the moment, but I remember having these books with them. There was a nice moment when I had a disaster with a mechanical cable layer. You start it up, you have to crank it to start it up. And the thing backfired and hit me on the nose. And 2 days later, we had an inspection by General Gott, was it, the chap who was killed in an aeroplane before Monty took over in Africa. And we'd had some boxing, and after some, I decided I'd better go ahead with this blinking boxing. And so by the time this general heaved up in front of me, I got a nice yellow and blue looking nose. He said, "How'd you get that, my man?" I said, "Boxing, sir." He said, "Jolly good show." But I took over the OCHU on Christmas Day because I was thought to be the cadet with the loudest voice from a drill. You know, everybody reverses, so I marked them all out of the place on Christmas Day. I also had this adventure at battle school. We went to Alswater for battle schools. And I'd been put in charge of platoon attack on a defended position. The theory was that you came under a fire, a tracer and things. And I caught, and then you're supposed to give orders and do this attack. And I heard the umpire saying, "My God, this is the first time we've had a bloke whose orders we could hear above the machine gun fire." And my nicest sergeant was a bloke called King, who'd been a regular in charge of one of these little wireless stations in the Atlantic or something, and he wasn't an infantryman at all, but he was terribly keen, and his section moved off for the attack before I got the smoke down to protect him. There was nothing I could do to stop him. So when we got to the colonel at the end of it and I reported in, he said, "Oh, very interesting, Tyler," he says, "but tell me, when you came under fire, why did A section move off before the smoke came down?" And I said, that's just what the bloody hell I wanted to know, sir. So that was the end of OCHU. I was post.
Now, during this early time, both the pre-OCHU and the OCHU, what about your political activities? I mean, did they stop altogether? Right.
Whilst at OCHU, whenever I was in the army, I spent all my leaves in London, in the House of Commons, as much as possible. I was there when the Beveridge Report was published. I don't remember what was said in the House of Commons about it. I happened to be on leave when it was published. So I bought 2 copies, went off back to Catterick, and I was very active in what was called ABCA, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. And under the auspices of ABCA, we used to have lectures and discussions on this and that, in which, as you can imagine, I played a full part. So when I got back to Catterick, I said, "Look, I'm volunteering to give a lecture on the Beveridge Report, which I've just brought back from London." And this I did about 4 days after I got back from London, and we simply sort of went through the bloody thing and just Everybody was rather excited, of course, you know, it was a completely new concept. Just about 2 days after I'd given the lecture, the army issued an army council edict saying there should be no discussion within the army or army bureau of current affairs of the Beveridge report until it had been presented to and discussed by Parliament. But I managed to get in before the ban came down. So I was also getting very closely involved then with the Fabian Society and formed a great friendship with the chap who was then the General Secretary, one John Parker, MP for Dagenham.
Well, could you explain a bit for people what the Fabian Society was and what its aims were? But it's not as well known as it once was.
No, I think you're right. But it was, again, you see, it was particularly important during the war because of the political truce. The Labour Party, as such, was not indulging in political campaigning, although it was running annual conferences, and I was attending those. I certainly attended the annual conference of the Labour Party in London in 1940.
I'll come back to that. Sticking to the Fabians.
Yeah, the Fabians. Now, they had been formed originally by people like Shaw, the grandson of my friend Pease. Yes, his name was Pease, and his grandfather's name was Pease. And if you like, intellectuals, if you like, to discuss socialist ideas, etc., although not to organise themselves into electoral organisations. So they were a very important part of Labour Party political life during the war as a sort of ally, which is guaranteeing not to fight any elections. Well, they didn't fight elections at all. They were really research and discussion places, but they were very much the centre of people with eyes. I mean, Strachey wrote a very well-known leaflet of that time. It's called Why You Should Be a Socialist by, I keep wanting to call him, not Lytton, John Strachey, wasn't it? The chap who became Minister of Food. Margaret Cole, the widow of G.D.H. Cole, was the chairman of the Fabian Society at the time, and a very, very able and effective woman, although with a gruff, manly voice, which was a bit difficult to take on board, but she was a very important part of the thing. And this was a sort of place where I could go when I was on leave in London and talk to members of Parliament, or they would take me over to the House or whatever. So it was an important part of my political education.
And what about annual conference? You said you went. You went when you were actually at school, from the sound of it, in 1940. But did you go again later?
Yes, I've got this thing upstairs somewhere. It might have been 40. Because I must have been at Cambridge. I think it must have been 41.
Right.
And, of course, the great issue on these occasions always was...
Who were you representing?
When I went first, I was just a visitor. Just a visitor. But the great hot issue always seemed to be that the Communist Party wanted to affiliate the Labour Party, and should the Labour Party agree to the affiliation of... Well, so the Communist, it wasn't the Communist Party that would come to party conference, it was the National Union of Mine Workers, who in those days had 600,000 members. So they were a pretty powerful body of troops. And it was poor old Herbert Morrison who always used to have to get up and explain why we... No, what am I talking about? The National Union of Mine Workers were, of course, affiliated to the Labour Party and were there as delegates with the votes appropriate to their 600,000 members. It was they who tended to sponsor, because their general secretary was usually a communist, it was they who wanted to sponsor the idea and did sponsor the idea and proposed motions that the Communist Party should be affiliated to the Labour Party. Now that was, in my recollection, the hottest issue in those conferences, and they never pulled it off.
Now you opposed that, did you?
Oh yes.
Could you explain why?
Well, as I saw it, you see, I mean, it was all mixed up a bit with this Russia and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that I saw a great gap between democratic socialism and communism, certainly as illustrated in Russia, or what I believed to be what might have been going on in Russia, they wondered. And of course, if you like, know everything. That was certainly, I had never had any doubts that I believe that Labour should be able to take over the government after the war. I believe that it had a programme of nationalisation, etc., in which the spirit in which the war had been conducted on a national basis would be continued, not in the sense of a coalition, but in the sense of a Labour Party who proved its ability to govern in the national interest. I didn't see the Communist Party as part of that. And I don't know that they had a lot of very good individual issues on which they were fighting. You know, I mean, it tended to be more on recognition and of saying Russia's a jolly good thing, which we all accepted that the Russian military effort was something we were all very keen on. And in support of that, you know, people like Stafford Cripps were dashing over to Moscow, so we weren't actually kicking the communists in the teeth. Sorry, that was...
Any other major issues at the time? I mean, was the Beveridge Report discussed?
Yes. Oh, yes, and of course it was universally welcomed. I think there was things like... of course, the opposition to the National Health Service was almost entirely from the BNA. And I think they... There was a whole feeling that after the war, things really were going to change. Although, of course, this got exaggerated. I mean, going forward to a wonderful moment from the 1945 election, it just illustrates this point. I had an old boy with white hair who made a speech at a meeting, pulled out his fountain pen and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have solved the problems of production. Under the Labour government, we will solve the problems of distribution." Now, this was part of an enormous sort of myth which grew up, particularly among Labour Party supporters, that once you had a Labour government in power, which would enable then the workers somehow to work twice as hard or twice as productively as they had under Toryism. And this was one of the great myths. I'm not one to exaggerate its importance. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that Clem Attlee was a very, very down-to-earth, although a very practical character, very much respected. But on the wilder shores of the party and its supporters, there were some very exaggerated ideas of what might happen under a decent Labour government, which of course then got tested later on.
What was the atmosphere like at conference overall during when you went?
Well, to me it was absolutely wonderful because there was the enthusiasm of the meetings, so the formal sessions, but then the informal side of it was just as important. People like Herbert Morrison would wander about the dance floor, chatting to everybody, and I guess because I've forgotten my Herbert Morrison, I haven't told you my Herbert Morrison story at Cambridge. That was,
tell us that then.
It's so difficult with these damn dates, isn't it? I suspect it
don't
would
worry.
Be March 42. We'd organised a meeting with Herbert Morrison in the Corn Exchange. And partly because of the Russians were having everybody was very, very